All right. Good afternoon, everyone. It is February 29th, and this is your second Rules Committee for the day. First announcements, we are going to roll over 1553B until tomorrow, so we won't work that bill. We're going to start, open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 1533B and invite up Senator Dembro, Martha Pellegrino, and John Chandler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Welcome. House colleagues. I'm Michael Dembro. I represent Senate District 23, which is northeast, southeast Portland, and the lovely, unique city within a city of Maywood Park. Very pleased to be here. I have about 5 pages worth of reading time to spend with you before
you
I have to be back.
Gavel him down, Madam Chair.
Yeah, you just don't want to go back to the floor.
Anyway, it's my pleasure to bring to you this final version of Senate Bill 1533. It's a bill that addresses our housing crisis in two ways. First of all, by lifting the longstanding preemption on inclusionary housing, allowing local governments to enact inclusionary housing policies. And it also creates a construction excise fee, which allows local governments to come up with the resources to help pay for affordable housing projects of various sorts. This was a very tough bill to get into its final form because there was a lot of concern. The real challenge here was to hit that sweet spot where we're lifting the preemption to allow local governments to come up with policies that really address local needs, but at the same time create sideboards to give developers comfort that their needs would be met and that the projects that they wanted to see happen would actually pencil out. And you know, at the end of the day, I believe we were able to get there by creating those sideboards and creating those comforts while, you know, coming up with something that I think really will make a difference for affordability of housing in this state. And I will say one of the things it really does is it addresses the challenge of workforce housing. That is, you know, we have a number of communities where workers are simply unable to live anywhere near where they work. And here, you know, we're talking about people like teachers, firefighters, police officers, people that you really want to be living in their communities because they have a lot to give to those communities. And for various reasons, the more we can make this happen, the better. So I'll leave it there. I'll be happy to answer any questions about it. Those sideboards that I mentioned are all laid out in the bill quite clearly. I just want to, you know, in closing, give my thanks once again to the broad array of constituencies that came together on something where it really would have been easier to get to know. We all know how much easier it is to kill a bill than to pass a bill. But eventually, people found a way to get to yes. I'm very pleased with that.
Thank you, Senator.
Chair Williamson and members of the committee, for the record, Martha Pellegrino representing the City of Portland. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 1533B. We have submitted testimony from the Portland City Council in support of the bill into the record, as well as some statistics and data from the Portland Housing Bureau, who really helped us provide a data-driven case about why now is the time for us to be able to work with the development community on the implementation of this bill. This bill actually provides enough flexibility for not just Portland but other communities to implement this particular policy in a way that takes the needs of those specific communities into account and takes the needs of the development community. So I'm pleased to have had the opportunity to work on this legislation and would certainly appreciate your support of it. Also just would like to acknowledge both Senator Dembro and Speaker Kotek and her staff for their hard work over the last few weeks to work out a compromise on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of 1533B. Just by way of context, this is a bringing to a head several long-standing fights in Oregon politics. Inclusionary zoning has been a fight every session since 1999. Rents have been a fight ever since 1985. Particularly now as rental prices seem to be an issue. Construction excise taxes have been a fight since 2007. So this none of these are new issues. They're kind of perennial, sort of fun-to-watch issues, but it's nice to finally put paid to them, I hope, so that we can move on and actually talk about ways to solve affordable housing in a more comprehensive fashion. And just by way of a little bit of background for the committee, you may have heard this in other contexts. According to the State Economist's Office, we should be building about 25,000 housing units in the state of Oregon, multifamily, single-family, for rent, for sale, every year. Last year, we built about 15,000. So part of the problem we're facing in the areas where we have high prices for housing, both for sale and for rent, is simply one of supply not equaling demand. And that 10,000 underbuild has been going on since the recession. So we probably have 100,000 units worth of pent-up demand that hasn't been met for a variety of reasons, none of which are going to be necessarily addressed by this bill. But the thing I'm most happy about this is I don't believe it's going to exacerbate the problem. Because one of the things in working with the leadership over the last several years on this concept is that whatever we end up doing in this body, it shouldn't make the problem worse. It should help all of us move forward by having more units produced. We think this compromise in front of you will accomplish that. And I think it's one that really is going to help move the issue forward. And one of the things I believe is important to recognize that the provision of affordable housing is not an ideological issue. It's not Republican or Democrat. It's not urban. It's not rural. It's an economic issue. It involves jobs. It involves land cost. It involves infrastructure costs. It involves all the pieces that go into the price of a house. And if we approach it, as I think this bill gets to, as an economic matter with the sideboards and with the incentives and all that, you're using the hydraulics of the marketplace to deliver the outcomes you want, which is more housing and more affordable housing. That's going to get much further down the road than treating it as some sort of an issue that can be solved by legislative fiat or agency fiat, because it simply cannot. I hope, personally, that this is the first step in a multi-year conversation about affordable housing. I mentioned in one of the earlier committees on this that I'm not sure that something that's been in the works for 40 years counts as a crisis. We have gotten to this state through a variety of policy choices, some inadvertent, some deliberate. And to get out of this mess, we're going to take some time. We're going to have to talk about land use. We're going to have to talk about tax policy. We're going to have to talk about infrastructure costs. We're going to have to talk about a whole bunch of different issues, all of which contributed to this. And we, from the home builder standpoint, pledge to be part of that conversation. Really appreciate the time and effort that people have put into this. The Speaker's office was involved in meetings for the last several years. Representative Kenny Geyer as well. We had an interim work group before the last hearing. We've had several rounds of fights over inclusionary zoning legislatively. And that whole process has resulted in this package of bills that we've talked about this session. This is one key component of it. I should also point out the construction excise tax. And that is something that we have agreed to. It's up to a local option, up to 1% a foot based on the permit value. That's new money. That doesn't exist now. It's dedicated back to affordable housing. And I have to tell you, my industry was not all that thrilled with providing a new funding source. We understand that it's important. We understand that part of the issue here for local governments in particular is to provide incentives to buy the price down, whether it be SDC waivers, development fees, that sort of thing. You have to have a funding source to do that. We hope by providing that funding source, we'll be able to see that happen. But I would be remiss, Madam Chair and members, as long as I'm on the soapbox, I'll make one more pitch, that the only new money put into affordable housing in this building for the last 10 or 15 years has come from the real estate industry. It was developed, the document recording fee, 10 or 12 years ago. Assuming this bill passes, it'll be for the construction excise tax. I'm not grumpy about that. I'm not trying to revisit old discussions. I am placing a marker down, though, that come the 2017 session and subsequent, I believe the state needs to participate out of general fund in funding affordable housing if it is, in fact, an issue for the state of Oregon. It's a matter of statewide concern, which I think we all would agree it is. Then one measures that in this body anyway in the most concrete fashion possible by how much money is put to it. We'll be back in 2017 to have that conversation. Thank you for your time. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Veteran of the 99 session. Got to ask you a question here, and I'm really not, it doesn't matter who answers this, and I really don't want you to get in the weeds that deeply. But the question would simply be, why doesn't the free market respond to this on its own without artificial stimuli?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, thank you for the letter high floater. if we had anything remotely resembling a free market, then perhaps it might. But we don't, for a variety of reasons, and I'm not trying to open up issues outside of the scope of this legislation. We do have high land prices. We do have infrastructure costs that are very high, and so on and so on. And it's simply largely because of the inputs, labor, for example, and it's not really a legislative issue as much as it, other than once the CTE stuff takes root, it's harder to find skilled trades in the construction industry now. Which drives the cost of those who are still working up dramatically. So there's a variety of factors that militate against simply a free market solution. The other thing, at the risk of sounding heretical, free markets tend not to distribute things all that evenly.
Okay. Senator Denver.
Madam Chair, yeah, thanks. And Representative Wilson, just, you know, one of the key aspects of inclusionary housing is that it's mixed income housing, right? So, you know, you think of those housing developments that are going in near where I live along the light rail line, where developers are able to get, you know, $2,000 a month rent for, you know, a not too large apartment. And so who's going to move into those? And, you know, if you believe, as I think many of us do, that we want to have communities that are diverse in nature, right, where, you know, people who are, you know, good working Oregonians can afford to live near those transit lines, you know. I mean, arguably, many of them need that more than the, you know, the wealthier people do. It's hard for the market really to deal with something like that. And so some concerted effort on the part of local governments, I think in this case, really does make sense.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to stress, if it was said by all three of you, let's just do a course together and say, this is permissive. It's not going to force Martha to go back and say, Mr. Mayor, the legislature is forcing us to do the stuff in 1533.
Madam Chair and Representative Huffman, that's correct. There is a local option both in both components of the bill. So a city may elect to implement an inclusionary housing program, has some flexibility about how to do that in the confines of the bill, and it has the ability to enact a residential construction excise tax or a non-residential, meaning commercial or industrial, and it really is a local option on both parts of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Vice Chair Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First question is for you, Martha. You represent the city to the west, where? It's north. Where did you work closely with the lobbyists from Maywood Park? All right. I just want to go on record without my dear friend Carolyn Tomei being here, turning this into the Human Services Committee for just a moment. I support this bill. I think it is an appropriate partnership with government. I think what Mr. Chandler said, why would you be a builder behind all these regulations, behind all the housing we need, and be excited about another tax. Forming a portion of which goes to our most vulnerable, is admirable. Let us not forget that government is not the answer, in my view, solely. It's not even the leader for helping our most vulnerable with housing. It's the private sector, the charitable sector, the individuals that you pointed out, Senator, who want to be part of their community, who want to live there and have, in your words, much to give. This is where the compassion for a certain part, maybe not the working families, but for a certain part of our population, they either have no homes or can't afford them. In America, in Oregon, in Maywood Park, and in Silverton, part of the answer, a key part of the answer, is individuals, churches, Habitat for Humanity, a host of people who are not organized, who are willing to pitch in, whether they're builders, property owners, or just charitable folks. Let us not forget that part of our partnership, because simply passing bills, in my view, will not solve our housing problem. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion, questions?
Madam Chair, could I just say
Senator
one thing?
Dembrough.
You know, first of all, Rep. Gilliam, I really appreciate those comments. One thing that I didn't point out is that of the proceeds from the construction excise tax, if a decision is made to do that, 85% of the residential tax will remain local for affordability projects, and 15% will go into a statewide fund to help first-time home buyers with their down payments for home ownership. You know, because we are, although this bill really focuses on multifamily, for the most part, rentals, we all do, you know, still want to nurture and promote that American dream of home ownership. And we believe that this will help with that.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
So, Tom Worley, Randy Tucker, and Gwen Baldwin. And that's all I have on the list. So, if anyone else wishes to speak, let me know.
I'm Tom Worley from the Oregon Center for Christian Voices. I heard my name first, so I suppose that means I lead off. I hope I have some comments that are germane to your discussion. I'm not coming from the economic side primarily. I'm coming out of my faith, which is how we proceed from Oregon Center for Christian Values. And we think it's our responsibility to speak up to represent those whose voices aren't heard as easily, those that are marginalized, those who are in poverty. Beyond that, I have participated in a faith-based initiative in Portland. I would like to read a portion of a statement we presented this last spring, because I think it captures voices more than mine and can carry the statement forward I would like to make. As people of faith, we have been given a sacred charge to uphold justice for all people. We are responsible for the creation of a community where everyone belongs, where diversity is valued, where dignity of the most vulnerable is safeguarded, and where all people have the opportunity to achieve their full human potential and thrive. To our shame, our neighborhoods do not reflect these values of justice. Despite the good efforts of many, poverty, homelessness, and hunger are on the rise in the metropolitan area. We end our statement, our appeal to you as politicians, as legal representatives of our broader culture, to respond to this need. I hope I get your name, Representative Gilliam. I'm a person of faith. And there's good efforts being made by the faith community, but not nearly in response to the significance of the need. I hope you're aware of the recent study that was done by this Portland Housing Bureau, neighborhood by neighborhood. There's 43 neighborhoods or 46. Numbers are not my strong suit. But if you happen to be African American, if you happen to be Native American, if you happen to be Hispanic American, at median income, there is currently no affordable housing in any of those neighborhoods for you in Portland. A lot of those folks, as I'm sure you know, are working people. Their human worth is not accommodated by their financial wealth. They simply cannot afford housing. You drive in Portland, you can see the need. The amount of people homeless is on the rise. It's not on the decrease. It's our responsibility to care for each other. I want to conclude with a quote that means something to me. I hope you find some room in your life for it. It's by a guy by the name of C.K. Chesterton. He was a Christian writer and novelist some time ago. He says, "We are all in a boat on stormy seas, and we have a terrible need of each other." Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs for Metro. Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. Let's try that again. I'm here today to ask you to amend this bill with the Dash B8 amendments, which have been submitted to your committee. Now, in saying that, let me assure you that I'm well aware of the dynamics around this bill. I'm well aware of the very hard work that's been done by many, many people, including those basically represented by the last panel. And I've submitted written testimony that details our concerns about the legislation. I would just like to note that Metro is excluded from participation in the construction excise tax portion of this bill. We have long supported legislation to reverse the preemption on inclusionary zoning, and certainly applaud the hard work of many, many people working on that element. However, we were surprised to find, after the construction excise tax element had been developed, that we were not included. And it could be because people are unaware that Metro is doing a lot of work, more work than we've ever done, really, on affordable housing. Back several years ago, we used to do a lot of affordable housing work that was more regulatory in nature and more, I think, less collaborative with the local governments of our region. That is no longer the case. We are focused on investment and implementation and not on regulation. And over the last 15-plus years, we have invested in over 700 units of affordable housing at 60% of area median income or less. There's more information on my written testimony about the kinds of investments that we've made. However, we've done that with very, very limited resources. We do have an existing construction excise tax that is grandfathered. It was grandfathered in the 2007 legislation and continues to be grandfathered here. However, it can't be increased by the terms of the existing preemption. The use of it can't be changed. And that construction excise tax can only be used for planning, so it can't be used to actually invest in any affordable housing. Obviously, the cities and counties of our region will have the ability to use this tool, and that's good. However, we're concerned that preempting Metro may cause the unintended consequence of ensuring that some of the existing patterns of regional inequity will not be addressed or will deepen. And that's because certain local governments, including the city of Portland, represented by Ms. Pellegrino, who is just up here, are likely to use the tools that are provided in this bill, and there are certain local governments that are likely not to. And then there are other local governments that may want to, but are so small that they may not have the footprint or the amount of construction activity to generate enough revenue to actually invest in affordable housing. Metro has the footprint and the ability to manage a program like that would be helpful in the regional context. And I should note also, even though we don't have a permit counter, We have existing intergovernmental agreements with every local government in the Portland region, every city and county in the Portland region, for them to collect our existing very small construction excise tax and remit it to us, and then it's remitted back to them for planning purposes. There's another thing that I'd like to mention, and then I'll end. There's a growth management conversation that has just gotten underway around the same time as this legislative session got underway in the Portland region. As you know, land use issues are always contentious and probably an order of magnitude more contentious in our region than in certain other areas of the state. So in the aftermath of our last growth management decision, we've convened a process among the local governments of the region to see if there are some possible improvements that we can agree upon and bring down to Salem to recommend to you in the future. And the first thing that was recommended by the mayors of the region is density transfers, which would enable local governments to develop at lower densities at the edge of the region in exchange for higher densities in centers, in downtowns, main streets, transit lines, et cetera. Now, higher density development is often more expensive, and certainly it's to provide affordable housing in that kind of development requires a subsidy. A tool like this at the regional level could facilitate those kinds of transactions where you could enable growth to be lower density at the edge in exchange for being able to invest around the region in those community centers that are much more appropriate places for affordable housing in the first place. There is more in my written testimony. I've distributed to you a little folder, or a little flyer, which is a very short summary of a longer report produced by our Equitable Housing Program. I would just, as I said at the beginning, I understand what's happening with this bill. I wanted to make sure that I was on the record and had an amendment for you to consider that actually reverses the concern that we've brought to the table. Even though it has a lot of words, all it does really is add the ability of Metro to use a construction excise tax, and I'd happily explain the amendment if you had interest in that level of detail. And I would like to continue the conversation with you going into the future about resolving this problem.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Gillum, and Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Gwen Baldwin, and I represent Multifamily Northwest. We are a trade association that represents the owners and managers and developers of multifamily housing across the state of Oregon. And I will tell you that when we first came to this session, we were not in support of lifting the preemption. But I'm here today to give our strong support to Senate Bill 1533B, specifically because it has evolved. The conversations have evolved. The work out of the Speaker's office, the work from Senator Dembro, the bipartisan support that you saw on the other side of this building is reflective of the fact that this is now a bill that is both balanced and feasible. And that word is not to be taken lightly. It is now feasible. You are going to see more housing built at all levels. And I think we are more confident than ever about the future of the ability to meet the housing needs of all Oregonians. And this bill is a piece of it. It is not the silver bullet. It is not the only tool that will be needed. But it is an important step forward, and we can strongly support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. So I'm going to close the public hearing on 1533B. I'm going to open a work session on 1533B.
Everyone waiting, I am now ready, Madam Chair, to move Senate Bill 1533B to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved Senate Bill 1533B to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Zoe, can you call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
No. No, I'm kidding. I just wanted to see the looks on the face. Aye.
Senator Moore?
No.
Representative Representative Rayfield?
Yes.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
No.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Chair Williamson?
Aye. Motion passes. Carrie will be Speaker Kotek. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1533B. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1600.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1600 authorizes prosecution of first-degree sex crimes after any time after commission of crime if a prosecuting attorney obtains additional evidence of crime, requires prosecuting attorney to present evidence reasonably tending to negate guilt to grand jury. This measure comes to you with no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, Madam Chair.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm going to invite up Brenda Tracy and Danielle Tudor. Come on down, ladies. I'll bring the rest of them up in a second. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Danielle Tudor, and it's a little nerve-wracking for me, I think, today, because most of you here, I have never spoken to you before. So I think Representative Chair Williamson, I think you're the only one that I have. So just bear with
me. Nicer than judiciary.
Much nicer. Yes.
That is great to hear.
And nicer than the Senate.
Way nicer than the Senate. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 1600, and it is a piece of legislation that has been very near and dear to my heart. And the reason for that is that it was the statute of limitations that actually kept me from being able to get justice as a rape victim. In 1979, when I was just starting my senior year in high school, an intruder broke into my childhood home. And when he first kicked in our door and saw me sitting there watching TV, he didn't have anything over his face. And he turned around, and I thought that he was leaving the premises of our home. And I was terrified. And I ran up two flights of stairs to my parents' bedroom in the darkness and picked up the phone. And at that time, we didn't have 911. So called the operator, got connected with law enforcement. And as I sat there in the dark talking to this person on the other end of the phone, I kept saying, when are you going to get here? When are you going to get here? And pretty soon, we had a small dog that had followed me upstairs. And pretty soon, she started to growl. And I panicked. I told the person on the phone, I said, I think he's come back. And she said, no, he hasn't come back. He was there to burglarize. You're fine. We're on our way. And I didn't believe her. So I got up off the bed in my parents' room and peeked around their corner. And I could see the staircase coming up to their bedroom. And I saw this man coming up the stairs. And it's a picture in my mind that I will never forget till the day I die. And he stood there on the stairs listening for my voice in the darkness, and he had come back in with something over his face, and he had gotten this large stick out of our garage. And as soon as he saw me peeking around the corner, he just bolted up the stairs. And as a child, I was always that one that was afraid of the dark, and now my worst nightmare had come to pass, and I was terrified. I was that girl that was saving herself till the day she got married. I had so much taken from me that night that I would never, ever get back. And the police finally did get there, but my rapist was gone at that point. And, you know, as he beat me and raped me, I didn't even think I would live through that night. And I did, and so many other victims had experienced the same thing by the person that became known as the jogger rapist. It was terrifying. And I went to the hospital, I did that rape kit, and I also gave law enforcement a very valuable piece of evidence that night, and it was a composite sketch of this man whom nobody else of the other victims ever were able to see. Unfortunately, that composite sketch did catch him, but it was 1986. 7 years later. Statute of limitations at that time was only 3 years. So he was apprehended after the rape of a 13-year-old girl out in Gresham, and that composite sketch came back into play, and sure enough, it was the same person. Imagine having to go through that court process, having to be cross-examined by a defense attorney, left in tears, only to know that this man that was sitting there on trial would never be prosecuted for your rape, and yet he's even admitted to them. After trial, he was sentenced to a minimum of 30 years and a maximum of 60 years. My justice is about to come back around again. I have another parole hearing on April 6th of this year, trying to keep a serial pedophile rapist in prison, someone who should have stayed in prison and should not be up for parole and would not be had he had been prosecuted for all of the rapes that we knew of. That's not even the ones that we don't know of, and I'm sure there are more. So today, as I testify on behalf of this bill, you can see why it's something that is very near and dear to my heart. I don't ever think a rape victim who does everything right to the best of their ability should be locked out of the justice system. I think every victim deserves their day in court if that's what they want. And unfortunately, many don't choose that, but some do. You know, it takes incredible, incredible courage for a rape victim to step forward and go to law enforcement, go through a rape kit, and go through that process. And we need to assure that the system will treat them correctly, that they will be treated with the bravery that they deserve. And this bill starts to put us on that track. There are other bills that are in this session and that have come and will come that are setting us on the right course. So that's my personal story. There are a couple things I want to address. One was in the last committee that we were in, a question was asked, and it wasn't asked of me or Brenda, but I wished I could have answered that question. But one of the panel members had asked, you know, how does basically a person, you know, when you go back in time, how can they even remember where they were on that time and date? And I think the date that was brought up was like February 24th, 2004. And for some reason, there seems to be this thought that all of a sudden all these he said, she said cases are going to come into play. And it simply is not true. This bill does have safeguards in it, that there must be corroborating evidence. And the other thing that you don't really hear about is male victims. And one of the statistics that RAIN, which is the Rape and Abuse and Incest National Network, they're one of the main ones here in our country. One of the things that they will tell you is that a male is more likely to be a victim of sexual assault than to ever be accused falsely of having committed an assault. And that is a very staggering statistic. And even in our country, 1 in 4 women can expect to be a victim of some type of sexual violence in their lifetime, and every 2 minutes, someone over the age of 12 in our country is being sexually assaulted. But yet only 2% of rapists are serving any prison time. So our system is way out of kilter. And I think that's what we're trying to change as we bring forth these laws and trying to make changes. So once again, I would like to ask that this committee will pass this bill out of this committee with a due pass. And thank you for bearing with me and letting me speak to you today. And I would be very happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Brenda. Hi, Chair Williamson and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Tracy. I'm here to also testify in support of this very important bill. I was part of the work group for
this bill, and so many of us worked very hard on it, people from all sides of the issue, which I'm sure you'll hear from the other side a little bit later. My own personal story, I have a long history with the statute of limitations here in Oregon. The first time I was raped, I was 9 years old. I did not report to my parents until I was 12 because my rapist lived next door and I felt like he would kill me. So when my mother reported to police, we were told, I specifically remember my mom coming to me and saying, Brenda, nothing can be done. The statute of limitations is up. I didn't know what the statute of limitations was at that time, but last year I would learn what that meant. 15 years later, I found myself with my best friend at another friend's house. I was drugged and I was gang raped by four men. Two of them went to Oregon State University. This time I decided not to wait to report. I didn't want the same outcome as when I was younger. So I promptly reported to police. I got a rape kit done. All four men were arrested. Two of them played at Oregon State University, so it was in the media immediately, and it was a big scandal at the time. It was 1998. The backlash over the next 2 weeks was severe and swift. I started receiving death threats. The community rallied around the football players and not me at all. I lost friends and family. At the time, the DA told me that I had a hard case to prove and that it would be difficult and I would have to go through four separate trials. I was not in any shape to do that. And when I weighed my options and the pros and cons, I decided to withdraw from the entire case. And I just retreated to a life of shame and silence. And for 16 years up until last year, I struggled with depression, PTSD, suicidal desires and wishes. I always regretted not being strong enough to push forward with prosecution. Last year, I decided to come forward with my story. John Canzano wrote about me in the Oregonian through an investigation. It was found that the DA at the time had lied. There were taped confessions from all four men. My rape kit was not tested. It was destroyed 3 years before the statute of limitations was up. So even if I'd come back, the confession and the kit was destroyed. And the statute of limitations was 6 years. So again, what was said to me is, Brenda, I'm sorry, nothing can be done. The statute of limitations is up. Last year, we changed the statute of limitations from 6 to 12 years. And I was happy about that, but it was bittersweet for me because that, even that extension wouldn't have helped me because my case was 16 years ago. But I was happy that we were moving in the right direction. When Senator Prozanski promised to put a work group together, I was excited and I was honored to be a part of it. This bill would have helped me. And it will help others. There are special circumstances in certain cases that do come up. And when they do, we should be allowed to see some justice. It's not okay that five men have raped me in my lifetime and not one of them will ever pay for what they've done to me. But I will live with their evil doings for the rest of my life. This bill, I feel, is a just bill. There are safeguards. I believe it protects defendants. I believe it protects victims. I think it's one of the most important pieces of legislation we can pass in this state. We are in the midst of addressing a backlog of rape kits of over 4,000 kits. This bill, along with Melissa's law, which I'm championing for the Bittler family, will send a clear message to victims in our state that we care and that you matter, because I matter and Danielle matters and every victim in Oregon does, and those are victims that will come after us. So I very humbly ask you to please send this on to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Kenmore.
Just a comment. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you both for coming and sharing your stories and all the hard work you've done on this bill. Thank you both.
Thanks. Thank you.
All right. Aaron Knott, Jeff Howes, and Gail Meyer.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General in the Department of Justice, here in support of Senate Bill 1600. Time is an equal opportunity destroyer of evidence, and if enough time goes by, you know, evidence has a tendency to disappear. So the fundamental task of a statute of limitations is to strike a balance between the deterioration of evidence over time and the seriousness of the underlying offense. Statute of limitations for misdemeanors are just a couple of years. For murder, on the other hand, it's forever. And in last year, House Bill 2317, as previously mentioned, extended the statute of limitations only for the most serious sex crimes, the four most serious sex crimes: rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, unlawful sex penetration in the first degree, and sex abuse in the first degree, from 6 to 12 years. It also spawned a work group which asked the question, is this the best we can do, given the horrific severity of these crimes, the worst sex offenses in our law, is this the best we can do? And the ultimate approach taken by the work group wasn't just to ask how long is the right amount of time, but what is the right kind of case? And that really led to a sort of shift of emphasis, where we stopped asking just how much time should go by and started asking what kind of a case did we want to see eligible to go forward. The ultimate approach we took was to require some degree of corroborating evidence, and we laid out some categories for what that evidence would look like. And I'll give a very brief overview about the types of evidence, but as I do, I imagine you'll notice that they link back very squarely to some of the stories you just heard. Now, that is not because we designed what we ultimately submitted around the stories of Ms. Tudor or Ms. Tracy, but because their stories are the kind of stories that plug into this legislation. There are other victims out there. So the broad categories of corroboration: first, physical evidence. You've heard about this. And physical evidence, people often think that it's fingerprints or blood splatters, something like that. But in the modern age, it can also be what we normally think of as testimonial evidence. Things like emails, text messages increasingly live forever. And they live forever in a way that, you know, it's housed on a server. It's very hard to modify an email once it's sent. You have to be pretty sophisticated to change a Google mail that's on a Google server once it's sent. Secondly, confessions. What happened with Mr. Gilmore, also known as the jogger rapist, is not that unusual. When the gig was finally up, so to speak, confessions can be made to crimes beyond the crimes that are known to the prosecutor or the detective at that particular time. They can say, I did this, and I did this three more times, and then provide specific information which, but for the statute of limitations, could be used to initiate an investigation. This addresses that as well. Third, corroborating testimony by somebody other than the victim. You've heard a number of cases where it occurs and a statement is made. A statement is made to somebody. Maybe it's made to law enforcement. Maybe it's made to a clinician. Maybe it's made to a social worker. Maybe it's made as part of a rape kit. That generates an independent record, which can be verified later. Finally, corroboration by another victim. This one thing we do know about, especially these very serious sex crimes, is they tend to be committed by individuals who commit them more than once. And coming forward is terrifying, but it becomes easier when someone else has already done it. That each additional victim offers new avenues for a detective or a prosecutor to verify sort of the methods used, peculiarities of that defendant, things that corroborate from one to another. So, I think this is a good approach. I think it's an equitable approach, and I think it is an approach that tries to strike that balance I opened with. I did want to close with one note. In the discussion leading up to this hearing, OCDLA, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and I had a discussion about sex abuse in the first degree. And the thrust of that discussion is basically there are some terms in that statute that we looked at in the pendency of this hearing. And our feeling was sex abuse in the first degree, which occurs when you make sexual contact with the intimate part of another person. And in the first degree, we're generally talking about a child, someone with a severe developmental or physical disability, or somebody who's being subjected to what's called forcible compulsion, but force. But that there's some terminology in there we'd like to visit in the interim, and I think we have confirmation from Senator Przanski and Representative Olson that that'll take place, so I just want to pledge my involvement in that conversation as well and urge your support for Senate Bill 1600. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Howes. I'm the first assistant to District Attorney Rod Underhill in Multnomah County. I've been a prosecutor for 21 years, and I want to just highlight a couple of the things that I've done because it brings context to this conversation. For 6 years, I was a prosecutor in the domestic violence unit, and I handled nearly all of the domestically violent sexual assaults that occurred in Multnomah County during those 6 years. Some of those pushed, I would say, the statute of limitations. One thing I learned early on in that stint in my career was that a victim coming forward to discuss these horrifically intimate incidents has no timeline, has no clock. A victim comes forward when a victim feels safe. And that may be immediate, that may be a year, that may be 5 years, that may be 10 years. It's safety that guides that victim to come forward and discuss what has happened to him or her. I prosecuted a case after I was in the domestic violence unit, State versus Edward Stokes, which was right at the limit of the statute of limitations, and it involved the sexual assaults of four young men by Mr. Stokes. And but for, I don't want to say a loophole, but an out with the statute of limitations, I would not have been able to prosecute that case. And Mr. Stokes was a serial rapist who had been sentenced to life in prison in California, but then released on appeal and came back up here, and we re-instituted that case against the victims in Oregon and successfully prosecuted him because we were able to work sort of around the six-year statute of limitations. I went from there to the child abuse unit in my office, and I worked in the child abuse unit for 4 years. Sometimes we would deliberately stop or withhold from charging a defendant because the child victim wasn't ready, and we would wait for the child's therapist to tell us that the child was now ready to go forward with this process. And it's a grueling process, and it's grueling for a victim. It's grueling for a victim's family. One other case I want to mention is a case I worked when I was assigned to liaison with the Portland Police Bureau Cold Case Homicide Unit. And as you've heard and you know, there is no statute of limitations for homicide. But this was a case that was 39 years old when it was brought to justice. And to bring this murderer to justice and to see him sentenced to life in prison on a 39-year-old case was something that I don't think the family of that victim will ever forget. And their gratitude for the efforts of the Portland Police Bureau and my office was palpable. This is a good bill. I was on the work group with Ms. Meyer, with Ms. Tracy, with Senator Przanski and Senator Thatcher. We worked very hard, and I'm not going to go over what Mr. Knott just said, but it was very accurate. We reached a place with this bill that I think seeks justice, and when it is employed, justice will result. The safeguards that are in place that Mr. Knott mentioned were the product of a lot of very serious, very cordial, but very serious discussion amongst the members of the work group. And every prosecutor that I know in this state and throughout the country, if given these mandates, that if you're going to prosecute a case that is beyond 12 years, You must have some other evidence that supports your allegations. That would be taken very seriously, extremely seriously. This will be the law, and prosecutors will follow that law. In addition, as you'll note, there's another thing that hasn't been mentioned, and it says that a prosecuting attorney commencing a prosecution under this part of the statute shall present any evidence reasonably tending to negate the guilt of the defendant to the grand jury. I would expect that any prosecutor would do that anyway, but this puts it right there in black and white. Put your whole case in front of the grand jury. Let the grand jury hear everything, the good and the bad. I would urge you to pass this bill onto the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think it's appropriate. I think it will bring justice to victims. It's got the appropriate safeguards. And I thank you for your time this afternoon. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Yeah.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I do have written remarks up on OLIS, and I won't be repeating them. OCDLA's stance on this bill concept is longstanding. Our institutional interests, we have grave concerns about these concepts. When allegations are raised for the very first time, 25, 30, 35, 40, 50 years after the effect, we feel the criminal justice system simply is not in a position to do its best work at that time. We have some solace from the conversations that have occurred, though, however, with the Department of Justice and with the representative from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, that there's further work to be done in terms of discussing the crime of sex abuse in the first degree. So this extension of the statute of limitations applies right now to four crimes, three of which I am sure everyone would acknowledge are the worst of the worst of the worst. Those are your penetration crimes: rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, unlawful penetration, sexual penetration in the first degree. That's the testimony that you heard from. Those truly are the worst of the worst. This bill also picks up sex abuse in the first degree. And there's been discussion and acknowledgement that that crime perhaps has not received sufficient work from this legislative body in really articulating exactly what it is that that crime encompasses. It's a very broad spectrum of behavior, but the entirety of it is scooped up into Measure 11 and is subject to mandatory minimum sentence of 75 months. It is completed upon contact, contact being defined as a touching of a, quote, intimate body part for the purpose of sexual gratification and arousal. The vagueness, the most vague term there, is intimate body part. What is intimate? And the Court of Appeals has essentially said, we don't know because the legislature didn't tell us. And they said, we know what it means to talk about an intimate dining experience or intimate knowledge of a particular subject or even an intimate relationship, but we don't really know what it means to be an intimate body part. Is it the bikini line, the bikini area, or is it more than that? And the Court of Appeals has opted for lack of guidance to be broad in its interpretation. And so to allow the definition of the term intimate body part to be described pretty much subjectively, the person felt that this was the part of their body that was entitled to be free from someone touching them for the purpose of sexual gratification and arousal. And there's a certain objective component to that, too. But what, like I say, there has been a broad spectrum here of conduct that's been scooped up within that phrase. It's included now the earlobe, the neck, lips. There was a famous Supreme Court case where a gentleman was on a beach, had his arms spread as he was leaning against something. A young girl was tossing a fishing line, and where she was rocking back, her buttocks, fully clothed, would rock on top of the hand of the man who was having his arms, and would consistently do that. And he said, am I bothering you with having my hand here? And she said, well, you are, actually. And he didn't move it. And she did it again. And then when she stood up, he brushed her off twice. That resulted in a prosecution for sex abuse one, and he was convicted, and he did go to prison for that. So the question really in the context of that crime with respect to an extended limitation period. What does this legislative body truly sanction in terms of having no limitation period for that kind of contact? There admittedly can be sex abuse ones, which are very disturbing to all of us, and it all fits within this broad spectrum. So we're pleased to hear that the Department of Justice and the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and others in a position of leadership and authority are in agreement that there will be a work group during the interim where we will have this very awkward conversation. We have looked at other states. We recognize now other states in defining their crime of a similar nature. Get specific about body parts. What's included in Sex Abuse 1? What's included in Sex Abuse 2 and Sex Abuse 3? So that work is ongoing, and it will begin post sine die, and we feel that if nothing else, that's a very necessary, important next step, because that is a crime that can scoop up a lot, and it's all subject to Measure 11, and we think that further definition is needed. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Comments? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. It's really a comment. When we look at these kinds of bills, I have a tendency to be skeptical of them. In my career, I've had short periods of time when I've worked as a prosecutor, and somewhat longer periods of time when I've worked as a defense attorney, and longer periods of time when I've worked as a forensic evaluator, as a psychologist. So I'm not entirely unaware of the kinds of issues that you're describing today. I think, as I look at this bill, you've done a good job of dealing with the kinds of concerns that the statute of limitation is supposed to deal with. And so after some thought, I intend to support the bill. I believe that the kind of effort that's done to mitigate against a false prosecution that puts a defense at great jeopardy years down the road is greatly mitigated by what's in this bill, and I appreciate it, and I think, and I'm very happy to be supportive of it.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. good bill, great bill, and I do plan to support it, but Gail, I would just add that I have concerns over the sexual abuse in the first degree issue myself. It's not quite enough to keep me from supporting it at this point, but it's darn close. So I really hope that as things go forward that this will be readdressed and the pencil sharpened, so to speak, on that.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you all. Thank you for your hard work on this and the work you will be doing in the future. Sounds like.
Thank you.
All right, we are in work session.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved Senate Bill 1600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes,
thank you. I apologize for speaking twice. I agree with Senator Wilson's concern about that one.
Senator.
Representative Wilson, it is late, and it's past.
Him.
My brain stops working at 5 o'clock. So
we'll be done soon, I promise.
Thanks for the upgrade.
Yeah, actually, it's a demotion, but we will tell them that. The story of the boorish behavior of the man who ended up going to prison is disturbing, and I hope that, in fact, the work will continue and will go on to redefine, to adequately define that crime.
Great, thank you, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know if saying it again makes it more so or not,
sure.
But I did really appreciate the conversation and Gail's comments, and I think that's, though I would never volunteer for the work group, I think it's wise to continue that conversation.
Yeah. Great, thank you. Are there any objections? No objection. Motion passes. I will be the carrier. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1600. We'll open a work session on HCR 209 timelines. Mm-hmm.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, HCR 209 establishes the deadlines for pre-session filing legislative measures for the 2017 regular session of the 79th Legislative Assembly. It's a measure that is done every even-number session to set up the framework for introducing and filing our measures for the forthcoming year. And this comes to you with no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Excellent. So we are in work session.
What a
unless you want to give some testimony.
No.
Madam Chair, I will forego my speech and move HCR 209 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? If not, motion passes. I will close the work session on HCR 209. I will open a public hearing and work session. I'm going to open just a work session on SCR 207, the Portland Timbers.
And Madam Chairman of the Committee, SCR 207 honors the Portland Timbers for the 2015 MLS Cup victory. The Timbers organization was here last week and did have the MLS Cup on display. So I'm not sure we'll be able to arrange for them to come back given the short timeline, but we want to make sure we complete this bill through the process and we provide them the due honor and respect for winning the MLS Cup.
And I know you all paid close attention to my my courtesies to the Timbers, where I cited a lot of really interesting facts and figures. So with that.
Well, Madam Chair, if I might.
You might.
I just wanted to ask you, and I enjoyed seeing the trophy and your comments, but aside from the goalies, are you aware that you can't use your hands in soccer?
I am.
Okay.
If
you're comfortable, I'm comfortable.
Can down in Southern Oregon.
Representative Rayfield.
I just was going to ask the chair if she would describe offsides.
No. I know it when I see it, kind of.
Okay.
Do you want to?
Do you really want me to?
No.
Yeah, can we have a division
motion
of the House on that issue?
Gavel everybody down. I haven't gotten to see that yet. So.
207. This one. With pride. Madam Chair, I move SCR 207 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam moves SCR 207 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any more discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. I will carry this. I'll close the work session. Erin, is there anything for the good of the order?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that completes our work for today. We do have an agenda scheduled for tomorrow, 3 o'clock, in this hearing room.
Excellent. All right. Thank you all. We are adjourned.